And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, this is the 10th day of September. 253rd day of the year. And leap year is 254th day. 112 days remain until the end of the year. In 506 A.D., the bishops of Visigoth Gaul meet in the Council of Agde. 1419, John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy, is assassinated by adherents of the Dauphine, the future Charles VII of France. 1509, an earthquake known as the Lesser Judgment Day hits Constantinople. They thought the world was coming to an end. 1515, Thomas Wolsey is invested as a cardinal. 1547, the Battle of Pinkie, the last full-scale military confrontation between England and Scotland, results in a decisive victory for the forces of Edward VI. 1561, Fourth Battle of Kawanakajima. Takada Shingen defeats Usagi Kinsen in the climax of their ongoing conflict. 1570, Spanish Jesuit missionaries land in present-day Virginia to establish the short-lived Achacon Mission. 1573, German pirate Klein Heinzlein and 33 of his crew are beheaded in Hamburg. They didn't put up with that. 1608, John Smith elected council president of Jamestown, Virginia. My ancestors were there. 1776, American Revolutionary War, Nathan Hale volunteers to spy for the Continental Army. 1798, Battle of St. George's Cay, British Honduras defeat Spain. You know, a lot of these battles in and of themselves weren't major. But the cumulative effect was the deterioration of Spanish power. Now, the Russians are hacking the Biden campaign, according to CNN. CNN reminds me of Chicken Little. They always run in circles and scream and carry on. Half the time, don't know what they're talking about. 1813. U.S. defeats a British fleet at the Battle of Lake Erie in the War of 1812. 1846, Elias Howes granted a patent for the sewing machine. 1858, George Mary Cyril discovers the asteroid 55 Pandora. 1897, Latimer Massacre. The sheriff's posse kills 19 unarmed striking immigrant miners in Latimer, Pennsylvania. 1898, Empress Elizabeth of Austria is assassinated by Luigi Lucchini. 1918, Russian Civil War. Red Army captures Kazan. 1919, Republic of Germany. Austria signs the Treaty of Saint-Germain-en-Laye, ceded significant territories to Italy, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia. 1932, New York City subways. Third competing subway system, the municipally owned IND, is opened. For the most part, the New York subways were acceptable. 1936, first World Individual Motorcycle Speedway Championship held at London's Wembley Stadium took place. 1937, nine nations attend the Nyland Conference to address international piracy in the Mediterranean. 1939, the submarine HMS Oxley is mistakenly sunk by the submarine HMS Triton near Norway and becomes the Royal Navy's first loss of a submarine in the war. 1939, the Canadian declaration of war on Germany gets royal assent. 1942, the British Army carries out an amphibious landing on Madagascar to relaunch Allied offensive operations in the Madagascar campaign. 1943, in the course of Operation Ouch, German troops began their occupation of Rome. 1960, the Summer Olympics in Rome, Abibi Bikila becomes the first sub-Saharan African to win a gold medal. Won the marathon in bare feet, no shoes. 1961, in the Italian Grand Prix, a crash caused the death of German Formula One driver Wolfgang von Trips and 13 spectators who were hit by his Ferrari. That's the deadliest crash in Formula One history. 1967, the people of Gibraltar vote to remain a British dependency rather than becoming part of Spain. 1974, Guinea-Bissau gains independence from Portugal. 1976, a British Airways Hawker Siddeley Trident and an INX Adria DC-9 collide near Zagreb in Yugoslavia. 176 people are killed. 1977, Hamida Danjoudi, convicted of torture and murder, is the last person to be executed by guillotine in France. 2000, Operation Barras successfully frees six British soldiers held captive for over 2 weeks. And contributes to the end of the Sierra Leone Civil War. 2001, Antonio de Costa Santos, mayor of Campinas, Brazil, is assassinated. 2002, in Switzerland, which is normally a neutral country, becomes a full member of the United Nations. 2007, former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, returns to Pakistan after 7 years in exile, following a military coup in October of 1999. 2008, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, described as the biggest scientific experiment in history, is powered up in Geneva, Switzerland. 2017, Hurricane Irma makes landfall at Coohoo Key in Florida as a Category 4. Caused catastrophic damage throughout the Caribbean. 134 people at least died and $64.76 billion in damage was done. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Let's talk about holidays observances. Amerindian Heritage Day in Guyana. Children's Day in Honduras. Christian Feast Days. Alexander Crimwell in the Episcopal Church. Albert. Blessed Thomas Sugi. Charles Spinola and the Great Martyrs of Nagasaki. Edmund James Peck in the Anglican Church of Canada, Nicholas of Tolentino, Theodard of Maastricht, Gibraltar National Day, St. George's K Day in Belize, Teacher's Day in China, and World Suicide Prevention Day. That's an international observation. Let's see what else we got. Interesting thing about Nathan Hales volunteering to be a spy. George Washington asked him to do it. 1924, Leopold Loeb found guilty of the murder of Robert Franks in Chicago. What was called the crime of the century. Mm-hmm. 1993, The X-Files debuted on Fox. I won't tell you my involvement in that. The London taxi driver George Smith is the first person to be fined for drunk driving in 1894. This is Arnold Palmer's birthday. Maria Theresa of Spain's birthday. Roger Maris's birthday. Colin Firth's birthday. And in 1945, Mike the Headless Chicken is decapitated in Fruita, Colorado. He survived for 18 months before he choked to death. Now, let's see. Jane Wyman died on this date. Cliff Robertson died on this date. And let's see what else we got. $13.49. The Jews who survived a massacre in Constance, Germany, were burned to death on this date. In 1382, Louis I, the Great, King of Hungary and Poland, died. And Mary, his daughter, became Queen of Hungary. 1487, Julius III, Italian Counter-Reformation Pope, was born. He was very much in favor of the Jesuits. Let's see. 1547, the English demanded that Edward VI, who was 10 years old, marry Mary, Queen of Scots, who was 5. 1547, Pierluigi Farnese, the Italian son of Pope Paul III, now popes were not supposed to get married, was murdered. 1588, Thomas Cavendish came back to England, the third man to circumnavigate the globe. 1808 of the Jamestown Colony Council in Virginia in 1608. Might be interested to know, before coming to Virginia, he'd served as a mercenary in Hungary, was wounded, captured, sold into slavery by his Turkish adversaries. He escaped, studied the Powhatan language and culture. Pocahontas was a Powhatan Indian girl of 10 to 11 years old, and she met Smith in Virginia. The Powhatans were in a very aggressive tribe. They conquered and subjugated more than 20 other tribes. Now, let's see. 1749, Emile du Châtelet, writer and mathematician, died from an infection that followed a pregnancy. She translated Newton's principle from Latin to French. Met Voltaire in 1733, and they hit it off and began living together. 1754, Captain Bligh was born. He was a British naval officer who was victim of two mutinies. The most famous was the HMS Bounty, which was taken over by Fletcher Christian in 1789. 1794, America's first non-denominational college, Blount College, later became the University of Tennessee, was chartered on this date. 1797, Mary Wollstonecraft, English writer, philosopher, advocate for women's rights, and the spouse of journalist William Godwin, died of septicemia. This was a few days after her daughter was born. And I'm sure you've heard about her daughter. She's known as Mary Shelley, who was the creator of Frankenstein. 1813, the 9-ship American flotilla under Oliver Hazard Perry defeated the British on Lake Erie by capturing or destroying 6 English vessels. With Commodore Perry's flagship unable to fight, an outmatched British flotilla faced the prospect of a remarkable victory. But Perry transferred his pennant to another ship and fought on. His fleet was home-built. 1823, Simon Bolivar, named President of Peru, and assumed the presidency with dictatorial powers. He'd led the wars for independence from Spain and Venezuela, Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. 1836, Joseph Wheeler, Major General of the Confederacy, he was a cavalry commander in the Army of Tennessee, was born. Well, let's see, 1846... I talked about Elias Howe. Got a patent for the first working lock-stitch sewing machine. He was a Massachusetts machinist, but his machine sewed only short straight lines. Tailors and seamstresses saw it as a threat to their jobs. Since he couldn't sell it in America, he took it to Britain, where he sold the rights to an English manufacturer in 1847. When he got back to the States, he found out that his patent had been infringed on by people such as Isaac Singer. And after a lengthy court battle, his patent was upheld, and the royalties made him a wealthy man. Let's see, 1849, Edwin Booth, brother of Lincoln assassinator John Wilkes Booth, made his first performance in Richard III. Well, let's see, 1869, a British minister invented the rickshaw in Yokohama, Japan. The rickshaw was developed as a cheap alternative to horsepower. Now, let's see what else we got. 1879, Pacific Coast Oil Company was founded in San Francisco by Lloyd Tevis, George Loomis, and Charles Felton. 1906, it became Standard Oil of California. 1926, it became Standard Oil Company of California, also known as SoCal. 1984, it became Chevron. In 2001, it became Chevron Texaco. Let's see. Anything else of interest? Mm-hmm. 1914, the Six-Day Battle of the Marne ended, and the German advance into France was stopped. This was considered a pivotal point in history for the 20th century. Well, let's see. 1942, the RAF on this date dropped 100,000 bombs on Dusseldorf. Now, 1945, Vidkun Quisling sentenced to death in Norway for collaborating with the Nazis. In October 1945, he was executed by firing squad. And in 1955, on this date, Gunsmoke, starring James Arness, premiered on CBS, and it stayed on the air until 1975. When most of the original players were too old to lift their pistols, much less use them. Okie dokie. I think that's got it. Now, we've been talking about strange encounters, and we certainly got a lot of those. Now, sometimes dreams seem real. And Mary Gledhill had a dream one night in March of 1929. She dreamed about an express train racing through the darkness. And it wasn't a remarkable dream for her to experience because her husband Jack was a train engineer. And in the dream, she saw her husband standing on the footplate, keeping an alert eye on the signals as he built up the speed and the his locomotive. He was aiming at another record run between London and Scotland. And it was nothing really out of the ordinary happening for most of that trip in the dream, because everything was running smoothly. All the signals were in the right position to give the night express a clear run without stopping. But suddenly all that changed. As the engine built up to maximum speed, The dash through a city station, the signal suddenly swung from the all clear to danger. And her dream changed to a nightmare. She saw Jack try everything he had learned in his many years as an engineer to bring that speeding train to a stop. But nothing could stop it. It was like some super powerful runaway monster. And then she heard the vicious rending of metal and clouds of hissing steam and an unbelievably loud crash, followed by silence. But before the wreckage could be seen through the smoke and flying debris, she jumped out of bed screaming, only to find her husband lying in bed beside her, asleep. Well, of course, her scream woke him up, and she told him about that dream. Next morning, she couldn't forget what she had dreamed, although her husband tried to soothe her fears by explaining it was only a dream. But she knew it was much more. She knew it was a premonition of danger, and she begged her husband to stay home that day. Well, he said he had to do his job. It was odd to question for him to stay home. And for the rest of the day, she was on edge, that so much so she didn't dare leave the house. She just sat in her armchair and waited for her husband to come home. Hours passed. The daylight faded. The twilight thickened. Soon it was night. Her husband was more than 3 hours late. She knew her premonition to come to pass. Finally, she heard a man's footsteps coming down the quiet street toward the house. That was her husband. His train had been delayed by a derailment near Carlisle, and he soothed her concerns by saying that had been all her dream had warned her about. And of course, she pretended to accept his explanation, but she wasn't convinced. Of course, her husband was only too eager she should forget her nightmare. He was prepared to do that. The weeks went past and nothing happened until one evening as his train was running into Doncaster. Suddenly, Jack Gledhill felt a cold sweat of fear break out all over him for no reason at all. Careful not to say anything to his fireman, he controlled the faintness that made him tremble all over. But the train swept on through the night without anything out of the ordinary happening. A few evenings later, he had a similar experience to the nightmare Mary had dreamed, but he refused to believe it was anything more than his imagination. But in his dream, the scene of the crash was just outside Doncaster, exactly on the spot where he'd felt faint a few days earlier. Then he had another dream about that same stretch of territory and about a train in which he was the engineer. Now, there didn't seem to be anything unusual about that dream trip. All the signals were set to give him a clear run when suddenly, as if out of nowhere, he saw another railway man appear in the dark track right in front of the locomotive. Well, it was too late for him to do anything about it as his train thundered on some distance before he hastily applied the brakes and was able to stop it. He knew he must have hit the man. Well, train finally stopped. He jumped down and ran back along the line looking for the dead body, and then he saw to his horror that the dead railway man lying on the track was himself. Now, this dream with slight variations came to torment him for 5 more nights. Inevitably, he began to believe this some kind of omen, and he talked about him to several people. But in September of that year, not having had his strange dreams for some time, he certainly wasn't thinking about him as he was once more driving a train scheduled to stop in Doncaster. All the way from London, though, the engine had been giving trouble, not pulling as it should have. When he stopped at Doncaster, he reported this, and arrangements were made to have the locomotive uncoupled and driven to the repair yard, and a fresh engine hitched up for the remainder of the journey. Jack was down on the tracks watching the men uncouple his train when it happened. There was no warning sound, no vibration. Suddenly a freight train came out of the darkness, struck him, and knocked him from the track. When his friends reached him, he was unconscious. A short time later, he died. Well, you know, sometimes, you ever heard the expression bread upon the water? Late one evening in October of 1890, as the winter mists were swirling around the lonely farmhouse in the Mendip Hills in Somerset, Bernard Collins glanced out the window and saw a frail figure staggering across the rutted cart track. It was an old woman wrapped in a shawl, cowering against the cold, damp weather. But somebody her age was doing wondering about such a place in this weather and at such a late hour puzzled him, so he sent his 9-year-old son Trevor running out in the twilight to invite the old woman to come in and shelter in the house. Making the old woman comfortable in front of the fire, they provided her with food and hot tea and made sure she was comfortable sitting in front of the fire. Boy took off the woman's wet boots and placed them near the fire to dry. Gradually, they heard her story. Said she'd been fired from her domestic job because she was too old and was making her way to live with her son and his wife. But since she didn't have any money, she had to walk all the way. Well, Bernard Collins insisted as the weather was so bad, she stayed the night at the cottage. In the morning, he took her the rest of the way to her son's home in his horse and cart. Well, a year later, the Collins had almost forgotten the incident. Until that day when Bernard was driving to the market in a nearby town. Before he left in his horse and cart, his wife told him that she believed there was going to be a storm brewing. Needed to be careful. Well, his business at the market took longer than he'd expected, so by the time he's ready to drive home, it was already dark. And he knew his wife was going to worry if he was late. So he decided to go by the dangerous shortcut through the hills because it would save him a lot of time, even though the usual road, which was longer, was much safer. The short route was a rough, hard road that had to cross a river that lay far below an old, narrow, rickety wooden bridge. Bernard knew if he missed this bridge in the dark, he'd had a long, fatal drop into the river. Well, just as he left town, the storm his wife had predicted broke in all its violence. The thunder rolled, lightning flashed, the rain just poured down. Bernard put up the small hood on the cart, and this afforded him some shelter, so he was cheerful enough, looking ahead to the time he'd be dry and warm at home. A few miles out of town, he recognized that same old woman he'd seen a year ago, standing huddled in her shawl by the roadside. Surprised to see her, Bernard told her to get in the cart. He said, "You certainly picked the worst weather for your little jaunts," he said, and she replied, "I knew you were in town. I was waiting for you." Well, even though what she said was strange, it didn't really have an impact. When he got to the junction, he drove into the road that would take him home, the short route. The old woman suddenly stopped him and said, "You don't take this road. Take the longer route." Well, he stopped the cart, and for a time they argued, but over and over the old woman kept insisting he ought to drive home by the longer route. And finally, to calm her, he did as she wished and took the longer route, arriving at last at his farm. Well, the old woman seemed to be asleep by the time he got to his house, so he went into the house to get a blanket to wrap her in, going to carry her inside. But when he told his wife the old woman was asleep in his cart, she just looked at him in total shock. "You say you picked up the old woman as you're on the way back with you?" And he said, "Yeah, she's out there right now." Well, his wife said, "Bernard, the old woman's daughter-in-law came here the other day. You had not been gone long when she came and told me the old bridge to the short route was down. I was afraid you were going to come home that way and go plunging into the river." And then the wife paused and gave him a funny look and said, "But she told me something else. She said her mother-in-law died 2 weeks ago." Well, not really wanting to believe what his wife said, Bernard went out the door and looked, and the cart was empty. The old woman had vanished, but she had repaid her debt. Well, sometimes strange things happen. And strange things started to happen at Beaver Lodge in Hammersmith in 1883. That was when the Richmond family moved in to make their London home there. They'd only been there a few days when they first heard those strange noises. Miss Richmond, who had been sitting one evening in the living room, was startled to hear somebody sobbing. She knew she was alone in the house, so she wondered what was going on and decided to get up and go find the intruder. Although the weeping and the sighing went on for almost half an hour, and she searched every room and every cupboard from top to bottom, she didn't find anybody. You know, a few days later, the heartbreaking cries were heard again. This time it was broad daylight, just before the family sat down to lunch. Once again, after a search, nobody was found, and there was no rational explanation that anybody could come up with. And from time to time, the wailing varied in its intensity and volume. Sometimes it was so faint it might have been the wind sighing through the trees. Other times it was so loud it almost drove the Richmond family out of the house. And one afternoon, when Ms. Richmond was having tea in the drawing room with a few of her friends, she glanced up and she saw the ghost. And so did at least two of her companions. Well, the apparition was surreal that for a moment Ms. Richmond thought a stranger had walked into the room. There was a tall, elegantly dressed woman standing behind him, and for some strange reason the vision was holding a shawl across the lower half of her face. Then abruptly the intruder sobbed and faded into the nothing. After this, Ms. Richmond and other members of the household encountered the woman's ghost on several occasions and at different times of the day and night. She was always concealing the lower half of her face with her shawl. A number of serious efforts were made to find some explanation for the haunting. Past history of the house was studied in some detail. People had lived there for many years in the district were questioned, but it was all to no avail. Nobody knew anything about the sad ghost or why she'd haunt that house. Now, it was argued by many the sounds might have been caused by water underground passing underneath Beaver Lodge. And the reason for this theory was that the house was on a site near some mills that were worked partly by flood water. But it was unlikely any underground water would sound like somebody having deep sighs or crying. Besides, the sound was only heard intermittently and for varying lengths of time. And finally, the one thing that such a theory could never have explained away was that the sounds were heard only when the ghost was seen. And although the mystery was never solved, one strange thing did happen. In 1920, when the house was being demolished, workmen found a skeleton buried in the cellar. Medical experts who were called in declared it was a woman's remains. And interestingly enough, the lower part of her skull had been brutally smashed in. Whoever that body belonged to was certainly trying to call attention. Well, sometimes people vanish. Sometimes they vanish for intentionally, and the other times they just walk around a corner and they're gone. Such is the case with Edgar Vandy. It was a hot summer's day in August of 1933 when 38-year-old Edgar Vandy, a brilliant engineer, and Ken Don and a friend drove from London to spend a weekend with another friend in a country estate in Sussex. When they got there, though, they found their host wasn't at home. Well, Edgar and Ken decided to be refreshing to take a dip in the swimming pool, which was some distance from the house. Now, Edgar was a very good swimmer, and it was a hot day. Edgar was not a good swimmer, but it was a hot day, and the pool looked so calm and so invitingly cool. At one end, the pool was 4 feet deep, and the other end, it was 8 feet deep. Like many swimming pools that we're all familiar with, the two young men went behind some shrubs to change into their swimming trunks, and then laughing and joking, they raced to see who reached the pool first. Edgar won the race, and Ken later told how he saw him splashing about in the water. It was a moment or two before he realized Edgar was in trouble, and he dove into the pool to rescue him. Although he succeeded in reaching Edgar, he wasn't able to get a firm grip, and Edgar sank under the water. He was dead by the time Ken got him out. Well, the doctor who was summoned by the police suggested Edgar might have been knocked unconscious when he dove into the pool because there were two slight bruises on his chin, one on his shoulder and one on his chest. Well, at the inquest that followed, Edgar's brother Harold and said Edgar would never have dived into a swimming pool. He was a poor swimmer and had never even attempted to dive before. Coroner's verdict was death by misadventure. But the end of the inquest was only the beginning of the mystery. A mystery that has never been completely solved. See, another Vandy brother, George, was a member of the Society for Psychic Research. And as they weren't satisfied with the explanation for Edgar's death, both brothers tried to contact him through a medium. Three different mediums held seances, and present each time were note takers. On each occasion, it was a different individual, and one seance was attended by Ken Donnan, who'd been with Edgar when he drowned. He felt Ken's presence might help make contact with Edgar's spirit. The three mediums were Miss Frances Campbell of Hyde Park Mansions, Miss Doris Mason, and Miss Naomi Bacon from the British College of Psychic Science. All three mediums gave accurate information about the manner of Edgar's passing and certain personal details later proved to be accurate as told by Edgar's spirit. But no real light was thrown on the exact cause of his death. Medium said his spirit didn't seem to want the inquiry to be made, and it appeared he really had slipped and struck his head. His spirit also spoke of somebody being near him who might have helped, but that person was too frightened. And Edgar's spirit didn't seem to feel any resentment. He was just merely sad because his death didn't have to be that way. Now, none of the mediums were given any prior information about the case, and each was given a false name and address by the Vandy brothers. But it is significant that information of a technical nature was given to him by Edgar's spirit about his work, which they shouldn't have been known anything about, as well as some information later proved correct that wasn't known to any living person. In spite of the other irrelevancies, there's no doubt the mediums gave a clear picture of Edgar's personality, qualities of mind, character, his technical ability. The sitting convinced both brothers that Edgar had survived death, but the real truth about his departure from this life remained a secret. According to Ken, he was the only other person there. And certainly he did his best, he said, to try to rescue him. So what happened? The mystery was never solved. Well, let's talk about a whistling ghost. Sean Lafferty came from Ireland in 1896 to work as a laborer on a farm near Long Parish in Hampshire, which is owned by Joshua Mander. Mander had the unenviable reputation of being the meanest man in the south of England. He expected his workers to slave away for long hours, fed them frugal and appetizing meals, only paid them when and if he felt like he doing so. So when the young Irishman came to his farm seeking work, the farmer saw in the lad an opportunity to get something for nothing. And he set Sean on it once. Having no place of his own to live, it was agreed that Sean would live at the farm with an adjustment to be made in his wages for his food and lodging. The farmer quickly saw how this arrangement could give him great scope for attaining another laborer very cheaply. And Sean's first meal wasn't very appetizing. It was supper, and all he got that day was a slice of dry bread and a small dish of badly cooked oatmeal porridge. And as soon as he finished this, Mander ordered him off to his bed, telling him he had to be up the next morning before dawn. Well, Sean didn't much care for this beginning, but he was in need of a job, so he said nothing. But it wasn't long before he began to regret having taken a job because the farmer worked Sean so hard, keeping him at it every single minute of the day, the poor lad began to feel permanently exhausted. The only day that Sean got any time off at all was on Sunday, and the sole reason for this was the farmer didn't dare work him all day on Sunday because of his God-fearing neighbors. They might say something about it. At the same time, it grieved the farmer to think of Sean having time in which to be idle. Well, the meals at the farm didn't improve, and the staple diet seemed to be dry bread and porridge. Now, Sean made friends with another Irishman, a man who worked on another farm nearby, but he didn't get a chance to see much of his new friend, For if the man even dared show his face at the farm where Sean worked, Mander chased him off, told him to be about his business, shouting that all Irishmen were nothing but lazy layabouts. Well, Sean, as you might guess, grew homesick, but his one comfort was to be able to whistle his favorite Irish tune while they worked. Farmer even tried to stop him from whistling, but at this, Sean showed some spirit. He said, "'Tis little enough pressure I have, and little enough I'd bring with me from dear old Ireland, but I brought me whistle and me Irish tune. Now nobody's going to take either one away from me." Well, Mander was angry, of course, at the defiance, but because the whistling irritated him. But he didn't press the matter because he didn't want to lose a good hard worker, and one that he got very cheaply at that. So Sean worked hard and received no pay. His wages were to be paid at the end of the six-month agreed period, but according to the law, if he left before then, his employer was entitled to keep his wages. By the end of 3 months, Sean had had more of the old man than he could stand and told Mander he's going to leave. The farmer said, "Suit yourself, but if you do, you won't get a penny. You only get paid if you stay the full agreed-upon period from planting time to harvest." Well, Sean argued he'd worked hard for 3 months. He said he would be content with 1 month's pay and give the farmer 2 months of his labor for nothing, but Mander, as was his nature, refused to give him a penny. Well, at this point, Sean lost his temper and said, "If you force me to stay on and work the way I've had to work for you these last 3 months, it'll kill me. Already it's whittled down me weight and made me a sick man. And I'm warning you, if you kill me with work, then when I die, I'll come back and haunt you." Well, at this, the farmer just roared with laughter. He said, "Get on with your work. I've wasted enough time listening to your nonsense." Well, it wasn't a month more before Sean was taken gravely ill and he died at the farm. Farmer's only concern was that he had to pay the funeral expenses, even though he didn't have to pay 4 months' wages to the dead man. Well, it was exactly 1 week later that Mander got the first indication. Sean kept his word. He was haunting the place. Working in a field some distance from the house, he heard the whistling. Now, he'd heard it before so many times he could not fail to recognize it as the Irish boy's favorite tune. Farmer began to shake, and then he saw the phantom figure of the dead Irishman coming towards him across the hill. Ghost got closer, and it said in a spectral voice, "You owe me, farmer, and I'll never leave you till what's owed is paid." Well, Mander, shaking with fear, is about to ask how he could put things right when the ghost just vanished into thin air. Farmer ran for dear life all the way back to the house, and that night he sought out the friend Sean had made on the neighboring farm. He gave that laborer a full 4 month wages that would have been due to Sean and begged the Irishman, "See this money gets to Sean Lafferty's family or I'll never know any peace of mind again." A few days after he sent the money to Sean's family in Ireland, Mander heard the whistling again and glancing up saw the ghost walking away from him across the fields. Apparently, the ghost was now happy. Well, sometimes death isn't the end. Jane Edwards found that out. It was the sound of her children screaming in terror that sent Jane Edwards dancing upstairs one night in February 1932. Rushing into the bedroom, she found them cowering under the bedclothes, and she comforted them and calmed them down and said, "What's wrong? What frightened them?" Eventually, the oldest daughter, Mary, explained they'd just seen their grandfather. He'd walked up the stairs, looked around the bedroom door at them, and then vanished into the other bedroom. That's the room in which he had died some months before. Well, wondering what had really frightened him, Ms. Edwards looked in the other room, and it was completely empty. Nobody had lived there since the grandfather died, because the roof needed to be repaired. But she didn't disbelieve her daughters either, as strange things had happened in that Wiltshire cottage during the past few months. And her daughters weren't the only members of the household to have seen something else moving about the house. She had also seen the old man. Well, apart from the 5 daughters, there was also living there Ms. Edwards' mother and her oldest son, James Bull, and Frank Edwards, Jane's husband. and they were all beginning to believe the ghost of Samuel Bull, Miss Edwards' father, had returned from his grave, for this phantom had been seen by all five children, and when they told Miss Edwards' brother, James Bull, he said he'd also seen his father's ghost. And one night the ghost then went into the room where his widow lay ill and put a cold hand on her brow. And when she learned that the rest of the family had all seen her husband's ghost, the old lady admitted it was not the first time she had seen her dead husband. After that, the ghost of the old man reappeared not only at night but during the daylight and was seen by the entire family. See, interestingly enough, the ghost didn't glide, but it walked and it spoke once, calling the sick old woman by her Christian name. On occasion, the ghost was quite queerly seen for as long as half an hour at a time. Well, Ms. Edwards was unable to describe the color of the clothes worn by the apparition, but she did state quite definitely he wore a scarf of a different color than the rest of his clothes. And there was one grisly aspect. She recollected that the knuckles of the ghost hands seemed to protrude through the skin. And it was something else. See, the family was always aware of the presence long before any of them actually saw it. They always sensed a peculiar restlessness before the phantom appeared. Ms. Edwards described this feeling as simply something similar to expecting a special family visitor whom one has not seen for a long time. The presence of the ghostly figure was certainly eerie, and made all the more so because the only light in the cottage at night was candles. Sometimes the ghost appeared during the daytime and when Frank Edwards is at work and the children are at school, but in every instance the apparition was seen with remarkable clarity. And all who saw the ghost noticed an extremely sad expression, and this was ascribed to the poor, squalid conditions in which they were living. And it seemed to be borne out later when the family had a chance to move into a new house because the ghost moved there as well and appeared to become much happier. In fact, the change in the ghost was so remarkable, Ms. Edwards declared she could detect a strange luminosity about the specter. Well, soon the children grew accustomed to their grandfather's ghost being about the house, and inevitably news of the spirit spread. Local man Admiral Hyde Parker learned about it and told the Earl of Selborne, and he reported it to the Society for Psychical Research. And one of the investigators, the Earl of Balfour, asked the local vicar, the Reverend George Hackett, to compile a report on the haunting. After the family moved into their new house, the owner of the old cottage decided to renovate it. So the vicar advised the Society for Psychical Research if they wanted to investigate, they had that quickly. The alleged theory that the Edwardses had concocted a story to draw attention to their bad living conditions was soon dismissed, because they all repeated their stories without any variation whatsoever. So the investigators were finally convinced the family was telling the truth. But no investigation turned up any reason for ghostly visits to the old house. Evidently, the ghost of Sam Bull was concerned only with staying with his family, and wherever they went, he went. That's no bull, folks. Well, if Victor Grayson was still alive, there's an expensive overcoat waiting to be collected by him from a hotel in the West End of London. Been there ever since the day he vanished in September 1920. And there's a fortune estimated to be several thousand pounds waiting for him to pick up as well. And that's the money that's been stockpiling to his credit from the disability pension he was drawing from the New Zealand government. Now, if Victor Grayson is still alive, he'll be probably over 100 by now. And he's the only person who can unravel a mystery that's baffled the world for well over 50 years. See, Grayson was a brilliant, wealthy politician who had everything in the world to live for and everything in the world to stay around to enjoy because he was at the peak of his career in 1920. And yet, for no reason anybody's ever known, he did something completely inexplicable and obviously impulsive. You see, he was with some business friends at a hotel in the Strand in London having a quiet drink. They'd been having a pleasant social get-together mid discussing Grayson's future plans. Suddenly he noticed everybody's glass was empty, pulled out a wallet stuffed with banknotes, and called the waiter over. Taking out a 5-pound note, which in 1920 was a serious amount of money. He ordered drinks all around, put the bank note on the table, and said, "I'll be right back in 5 minutes so nobody steal my drink." Well, the hotel doorman knew Grayson very well and opened the front door for him. Grayson greeted him cheerfully as he passed by and walked into the busy Strand. For a second, he seemed to hesitate, looked about him, and walked quickly off down the street. And that was the last time anybody has been known to have seen him. And nobody's ever discovered why Grayson chose to vanish so completely and suddenly. And nobody's found out what made him leave. And nobody knows where he went. But his disappearance caused a huge political mystery and is still an active file at Scotland Yard. You see, Grayson was no ordinary man. He was a man who raised himself from a backstreet slum in Liverpool to become one of the most prominent political figures of his day. His first job was as a boy laborer at a factory, but there was an earnest restlessness about him that made him go to sea to see something in the world and also educate himself at the same time. By the time he came back home, he had taught himself to read, write, and picked up a smattering of several European languages. Just enough knowledge to give him a thirst for more. Well, after more than 3 years at a factory, studying at nights in his room, Grayson won a scholarship to the university. See, Grayson had a great plan, and this was all part of it. He worked hard at Manchester University, where he aimed for and succeeded in getting an honors degree. And all his spare time as an undergraduate was spent in public speaking lessons. Lost his working-class accent. And then at 25 years of age, newly graduated, he hit the headlines for the first time as socialist candidate in the 1907 election. He unseated the Liberal incumbent from a safe Liberal seat. Without any real Labour Party support, Grayson became the first socialist member of Parliament. And his success made him a popular hero with the working and intellectual class. An adulation which Grayson adored, because he was the complete exhibitionist. Handsome, well-dressed, well-spoken, brilliant. In a remarkably short time, he became the idol of English society, married the beautiful daughter of a wealthy merchant banker, and many politicians predicted one day he'd become the British Prime Minister. Well, in 1913, he lost his seat in Parliament. But that didn't worry him. He told everybody he'd return to politics. At first, he wanted to spend some time with his wife and family. He sailed for New Zealand with his wife and family, and then the wife and daughter, and the First World War broke out. He joined the New Zealand Army, where he rose through the ranks to become an officer. His bravery and qualities as a leader saw him mentioned in dispatches on many occasions.
Even more than his bravery in one campaign, he was badly wounded, resulting in his discharge and the award of a disability pension. And this was the beginning of a run of bad luck for the man. Shortly after he came back to London with his wife and daughter, his wife died. Depressed for several years, and he lived quietly near Liverpool with his daughter. Then suddenly he sent her to live with his wife's parents and announced he's going to return to politics. And he threw himself into work eagerly. Appeared to have overcome his sadness. The beginning of September 1920, he left his home in Liverpool to address a political meeting in Hull. This was to have been his second debut. And his friends all remarked on how exuberant he seemed, how full of confidence he was for the long battle back to Parliament. And after leaving Liverpool for Hull, the first strange thing happened. See, Grayson went to London instead of Hull. For a few days, he attended parties, luncheons, and race meetings with old friends. Never once did he make any reference to the meeting in Hull. Everybody he met in London remarked on the return of the old Grayson, the gay, confident extrovert who was the life and soul of the party. But then, he vanished, leaving his overcoat, several pounds changed from his round of drinks, and a group of baffled friends and business colleagues. For the next 10 years, nothing was heard about him. He had vanished more completely than anybody could ever believe possible. Then in the 1930s, reports began to filter back to his friends and relatives he'd actually been seen. Somebody had recognized him at a race course near Cape Town. He'd been seen working on a sheep ranch in Australia. or living in a lodging house in a Skid Row area of London. Now, each of these rumors was investigated, but nothing came of them. Then two of the men who'd last been in his company reported to Scotland Yard they'd seen Grayson on two occasions. First time, both men had been standing in Charing Cross chatting. Feeling somebody was watching them, they looked around and saw a smartly dressed Victor Grayson across the street. They both swore he grinned at them and walked off. When they tried to cross the street, he hailed a cab and drove away. Taxi cab driver was questioned, and after identifying Grayson's photograph, said he dropped off his passenger in St. James Park. Second time he was seen by one of those close friends was in 1940 during the war. When the man saw Grayson and a woman on a subway, this time Grayson looked old and more tired and strained and wearing an officer's uniform. As the other man pushed through the crowd toward Grayson, he heard the woman address her companion as Vic. Then they both moved through the crowds, arm-linked, and went out of the station. Grayson's friend ran after him, but once again, Victor Grayson vanished into the crowded Strand. And that was the last time anybody had ever seen him. It was a major mystery. And as I say, it's still an open case. At least it was. Well, sometimes people see things that in later examinations you're not to be there. Keith Painter was a traveling salesman whose job took him all around England. He often drove for long distances to see his customers. And this led to his strange experience in October 1928. Spending a profitable day in Huddersfield, he set out to drive to a small town in Wales, where he had several appointments for the next day. And it was a long journey, and he didn't reach his destination until a little well after midnight. He'd also forgotten to make hotel reservations. As he drove into that small Welsh town, the streets were deserted. The shops were shut. There didn't seem to be anybody about who could direct him to a hotel or a guest house. So he drove around the streets, wondering what he was going to do, and suddenly saw a shop window ablaze with light. Stopping his car, he walked up and peered through the window. It was a butcher shop, and the window was piled high with joints of meat and pies and sausage and other merchandise. And then he saw the man standing in the shop. By his clothes, Painter decided it was the shopkeeper himself. He couldn't see the butcher's face as the man was standing with his back to the window, bending forward to peer into a refrigerated cabinet. Now, Painter was surprised to see the butcher in his shop at such a late hour. And it was unusual to have meat in the window all night as well. But he was glad the man was there, for he hoped to be able to direct him to some place where he could spend the night. So he tapped on the window to attract the butcher's attention, but the man didn't look around. So Painter tapped even harder, and this time the man slowly turned and stared out the window, and Keith Painter reeled back in horror. The butcher's throat had been slashed with the chopper he was holding in his hand, and the blood was spouting all over his white jacket. Well, Painter rushed around and tried to open the door, but it was locked. So he ran along the road to the telephone booth and telephoned the local police station. By the time the patrol car arrived, the lights in the shop were out. So the police listened calmly to his story and directed him to a hotel. Now, Painter was shocked at their nonchalance, but was too upset and too tired to do anything other than make his way to the hotel, pay for a room, and go to bed. Next morning, he asked the local manager if the police had been there looking for him, and the manager looked puzzled and asked what was wrong, so Painter told him what he had seen at the butcher shop. Well, he stopped talking when he saw the landlord and suddenly looked back at him in total shock. He said, "What's the matter? Did I see something wrong?" And the man said, "Did you say you saw the butcher shop?" And Painter nodded, and he said, "Well, you couldn't have seen that. I mean, the shop's empty for more than a year now." Well, it was Painter's turn to be shocked, and he said, I did see him." Then he broke off and stared at the landlord, realizing he must have seen a ghost. And realizing, too, why the police had seemed so calm about the news. See, the man that ran that shop was almost bankrupt. About a year ago, he's found lying across the coal cabinet with his throat cut. Well, we're going to go to, it's the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow night. Once again, if you're listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show, until then, have a great evening.